regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federal Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. This afternoon, we are pleased to be having a conversation about Certificate of Need Laws and Healthcare Access, featuring Christina Sandifer, who is the Executive Vice President at the Goldwater Institute, and Josh Windham, who is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. Christina and Josh, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
Doing well, thanks Great. For having us.
Great, thank you for joining us. If our audience would like to learn more about each of our speakers and their work, they can visit regproject.org, that's regproject.org, where we have their full bios. In a moment, I'll turn it over to Christina to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion, we'll go to audience Q&A. So audience, please do think of the questions you'd like to ask our speakers. Thank you all for joining us. Christina, the floor is yours.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much, and thanks to everyone out there joining us. You know, this topic, public preparedness and really the ability to address healthcare issues and even healthcare crises, is probably on the minds of many of you that are listening today as concerns over the coronavirus continue to grow. So this teleform is especially relevant. But it's broader than that. Today, we're talking about Certificate of Need laws, sometimes referred to as CON laws, and these laws limit the supply of services and facilities only to what is needed, and that is determined by a state board or a state agency. Now, what some of you may not know is that these laws are actually on the books in 38 states. And of course, they vary from state to state, but essentially, healthcare cons make it illegal for providers to offer healthcare services or healthcare products to patients without first getting government permission. And often, as we'll discuss today, that permission is denied, not because of, you know, a particular harm to public health, but just to prevent legitimate economic competition against existing providers. Now, that is not the reason that con laws began, that is not the stated reason for them. Defenders of con laws will say that they're needed to control healthcare costs. This argument kind of goes back to the late 19th century. We first saw con laws start to be passed. They were really originally there to govern railroads and streetcars and public utilities and things like that. And again, the argument was controlling costs. Now, later, cons expanded to all sorts of other industries. Today, you see them in governing moving companies and, again, in industries like healthcare. Now, the theory behind these laws is that competition in these industries, so in the healthcare industry especially, is economically wasteful and that really a state agency is better suited to decide what's needed for the public and to really avoid unnecessary duplication, which they claim comes from competition, and which would, as the theory goes, mean higher healthcare costs for consumers. Now, this argument grew to be so popular that in the 1970s, it was really embraced by the federal government. And the federal government started encouraging states to adopt these con laws in many areas, but especially in healthcare. And actually, the federal government even offered funding in the form of subsidies to states that would adopt these laws. So, as you're probably not surprised to hear that in the coming years after the federal government started encouraging states to do this, nearly every single state in the country adopted a form of Certificate of Need laws. Soon, though, and very soon afterwards, it became quite clear that this experiment in cost control was an absolute failure. So in years since then, the Federal Trade Commission, the Department of Justice, many government, federal government agencies have done studies, and they found that, and this will be of no surprise to those of you who are well-versed in economics, eliminating competition, it actually drives up costs. costs, it reduces quality, and it limits the availability of needed services. And there's nothing unique about the healthcare industry that makes it respond differently to the laws of economics. Many private economists have similarly denounced certificate of need laws for failing to contain costs. Again, we have decades now of data that we don't just have to look at economic modeling. We can look at reality and see that they failed to contain costs and instead have actually protected entrenched businesses at the expense of applicants, of people who are applying to the government for a certificate of need or for permission to be able to offer their goods or services, and also at the expense of public health. That really got the American Medical Association to come out and say that con laws are actually a failed public policy. And so they've been denounced across the board, economists, medical professionals, and again, even the federal government itself, which reversed course eventually, stopped subsidizing con laws and actually has strongly advocated for their repeal in the states. It is not uncommon to see the FTC or the DOJ actually go into states and advocate for those legislatures to repeal their certificate of need laws, especially in the area of healthcare. Now, again, this issue is particularly relevant today. We are dealing with the impact and potential worsening impact of a global health crisis. And so there are, you know, concerns. We have leading analysts in the U.S. that are actually acknowledging that this bureaucratic system, this certificate of need system that exists still in most states today, might prevent us from responding to this crisis with the urgency that's necessary. So relevant today will be relevant tomorrow, will be relevant beyond the current crisis that we're facing. Now, you might think, okay, well, it's very rare that we see the federal government out ahead of the states on an issue like this. It's very rare that we see economists and medical professionals and everyone kind of on the same page on this issue. And so why is it that many state con laws still remain on the books today? Why is it that we have 38 states with healthcare cons? Well, again, one reason could be that existing providers benefit quite handsomely from these laws because these laws empower them to bar others from serving patients and the general public. So when somebody comes in and asks for a certificate of need, asks for permission from the government to be able to serve patients, to offer a new service, or to increase services in a particular area, the government gets to make the decision of whether that's needed, and existing providers can object if they don't think that that service is needed. And as you can imagine, most of the time, existing providers would not want to authorize competition in their area because that allows them to keep the market to themselves. And again, unsurprisingly, that drives up prices and decreases access. What I've just described is, in my mind, inherently monopolistic. So again, these firms are going to invest time and resources in preserving that anti-competitive monopolistic power that these laws give them. Now, it isn't all bleak out there. There have been efforts, legislative efforts, to repeal con laws. Some of them have been successful despite the politics, but there also might be hope in the courts, and that's one of the main topics we want to focus on today since this is a legally focused call. Again, you know, because these laws are very anti-competitive, they actually violate a host of constitutional provisions, including something called anti-monopoly clauses that exist in some state constitutions. And that's what we really want to focus on today. Now, there are actually several courts out there that have observed in other contexts that con laws are inherently anti-competitive. And there are some cases that have been filed under state anti-monopoly clauses challenging these certificate of need laws. One in particular that's being litigated by our friends at the Institute for Justice and is going on today. So with that, again, joining me to discuss all of this and to discuss the IJ case against certificate of need laws in North Carolina is Josh Windham, an attorney with the Institute for Justice. And Josh, why don't we start by just talking a little bit about the background of your lawsuit? You're defending a North Carolina doctor who's being blocked from helping his patients by one of these certificate of need laws. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about what he wants to do and why he's blocked from doing that.
Sure. I think the best way to start is to talk about kind of what he observed in the real world, in his medical practice and in his experience with patients that prompt this litigation. So Dr. Singh is a general surgeon. Patients, you know, as a general surgeon, he needs to figure out what's going on inside the human body. And it often helps to be able to see that with imaging. So, you know, sometimes he orders images for his patients, MRI, CT, that kind of thing. And patients would come back to him and say, you know, Dr. Singh, I tried to get a scan, but I had several problems. Maybe I had to spend hours on the phone trying to talk to insurance companies or hospitals or imaging centers trying to get a reliable quote on the price. Maybe I was double billed for, you know, the cost of the dye later on, and I wasn't told in advance I was going to be billed for that, and I can't afford it. Or maybe just the cost of the scan is far too high for me to afford it. North Carolina is one of the most expensive places in the country to get an MRI scan. The average cost there is about $2,000 for a scan. So Dr. Singh thought to himself, you know, I need to do something about this problem. That's why I went into medicine to help my patients, and I can do something about it, so I'm going to try. And he opened his own imaging center. The idea behind the center was that he would provide low-cost scans to patients who need them at affordable, transparent prices. So when I met Dr. Singh, I drove up to his imaging center, and he's such a lovable guy. He had a banner posted on the side of his building that listed, like in big font, all the prices for his scans. So it would say like MRI, $500, you know, CT scan, X, ultrasound, X, right? And it was just such a cool thing to see that, because you don't see medical, you know, service prices advertised in that way. And he sort of commits to, this is the price, I'm fully transparent, you won't be billed anything else. And if someone comes to me with a quote from another provider, not only will we match that lower price, but we'll give you an extra $50 off. So he's very committed to providing sort of low-cost scans for his patients. And, you know, when he opened the center, he was able to purchase most of the equipment he needed to get it up and running. He was able to purchase or lease an X-ray machine, ultrasound machines, a CT scanner, but he found that he was categorically banned under North Carolina law from purchasing, leasing, or even accepting as a gift an MRI scanner. And the reason for that was because the state had already determined in advance that there wasn't a need for a new scanner in his area under the state's con law. And so he thought to himself, this is wrong. This is anti-competitive. Someone needs to put a stop to it. And why not me?
Let's talk about that for just a second. The state determined in advance that there wasn't a need. Like, let's unpack that a little bit, because to me, when I think about that, imagine, you know, if McDonald's or if Starbucks had to come in and ask permission from the state to operate. And, you know, if 15 years ago Starbucks had said, look, we think that on every single corner there has to be a coffee shop that sells coffee at, you know, $5 a coffee. I think probably most bureaucrats, and probably myself as well, would say, well, nobody's going to buy that, and we don't need a coffee shop on every single corner in every single city. And yet, it turns out that's exactly what the market wanted and needed. So how is it that they made this decision in North Carolina that, you know, an MRI machine wasn't necessary for this area?
So this is a really good thing to talk about for a bit, because nobody thinks that Steve Jobs would have produced the iPhone or Apple would have produced the iPhone if someone in advance would have had to determine that there was a need for the iPhone, right? Like, innovation doesn't happen through government offices using algorithms and calculators to determine what the people need. You know, that's kind of how the Soviet Union tried to do things. But that is not how things are supposed to work in America. It's supposed to be a supply and demand economy where consumers and producers can make choices about the services that are needed for them. And so, Christina, you said earlier that con laws typically need is determined by state boards and state agencies. And that is true. But it's also true that when state boards and agencies are determining what services are needed, what they really look to is how many producers of the services actually already exist. So there's a sense in which need is determined by who's already in the market. So just to give you kind of a very real concrete example, Dr. Singh, there's like 16 or 17 MRI scanners in his what's called planning area in North Carolina. And so, you know, state bureaucrats in Raleigh get their calculators out and they use their algorithms and they say, okay, there's 16 or 17 MRI scanners. They're performing this many scans per year. We don't think there's a demand for more scans in the area. Therefore, Dr. Singh can't purchase one. However, the year after we filed the lawsuit, the number of scans slightly changed and one of the scanners disappeared in the record keeping system. And all of a sudden you found that there was a new need for a scanner in Dr. Singh's planning area. So what you find is that if one scanner goes away, one need pops up, right? So the reason Dr. Singh can't get a scanner is that the provider down the street already has one. It's a one-to-one thing. And that is the definition of an anti-competitive law. And just to kind of answer the question that folks might be asking, why doesn't he just apply for a scanner now? Well, the need has disappeared. And during the time the need existed, he didn't have the money to apply for one. We can talk about this a bit later, but it's incredibly expensive to successfully apply for a certificate of need.
Well, and so you're not just talking about how many providers there are either, right? I mean, the services are actually qualitatively different. You just mentioned that Dr. Singh posts his prices up on a board so that it's very transparent.
Yeah.
People know what they're getting into. I mean, is that the case of the competitors that are actually in the market? It doesn't sound like it. And so it's not just that the determination is being made regarding how many physical scanners are needed, but it's also how those services are provided. And that seems to me something that is impossible for a bureaucrat to know what's needed or wanted, right?
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, I'll say two things about this. One is that, in the lead up to the case, we were doing some research on what the state actually knew about which providers were where and how many scans they're performing and how they knew that. And what we found out is that the state doesn't have any way of tracking who has what scanners. So like they're making these determinations about people's lives, about their health, about their finances, and they can't really even say with certainty which scanners are where and who's using them. It's really quite embarrassing. But to your point about prices and quality, yeah, I mean, Dr. Singh wants to provide an innovative service, right? Something that is competitively better than what his competitors in the market are providing now. That's why he wants to offer it. He thinks he has something to add for consumers. And yet he's being told, no, your cheaper services, just as high quality, are not needed by patients you know who are telling you that they need them.
And of course, the reasoning behind certificate of need laws is supposed to keep costs down and make sure that medical services and equipment are needed. And what you're basically saying is the way this is playing out in North Carolina is exactly the opposite. Let's talk a little bit about the process. You mentioned it was really expensive, and I know at the Goldwater Institute, we had filed a similar lawsuit in Georgia. There was a couple of OBGYNs that did outpatient surgery, and they had a real state-of-the-art facility, and they actually, all they wanted to do is add another surgical room, another operating room in their facility, bring in actually other doctors, so people that, that actually surgeons from other facilities, so that they could do more surgeries simultaneously and help more patients. And again, the fewer surgeries that are going on in a surgical center, which is going to be cleaner, more cost-effective, the better for patients. They applied for a CON, which eventually was denied because existing hospitals objected to it. And when they applied, it cost them, I mean, it took months and months to go through the application process. It cost thousands of dollars. I mean, we're not just talking about, $50 and filling out one piece of paper, right? This is extremely expensive. Then you've got to wait. And so I imagine that there are a lot of people that don't even apply for these certificates of need in the first place, just because the cost is prohibitive, especially if they know it's very unlikely that they're actually going to get it granted. Is that your experience as well?
That's absolutely true. I can say two things on this. One is that, Dr. Singh, he has been prevented from applying for a CON because of the cost. And I can talk a little bit about why it's so expensive. I mean, it's not just, so in North Carolina, you have to pay a non-refundable $5,000 application fee just to submit this piece of paper that says you're applying, which is in itself kind of crazy, right? But more than that, the process of actually applying for a certificate of need is so involved. I mean, you have to show that you're going to meet tons of different criteria, one of which is that the service is needed, obviously. But in order to meet these criteria, you typically have to hire like an economist, an architect, a lawyer. You have to hire a team of consultants, basically, who can help you put together a competitive application for a CON. And there's actually a cottage industry, at least in North Carolina, and I'm sure in other states as well, of folks who are employed solely as consultants for certificate of need applications because it's so complex. And so part of what makes it expensive isn't just hiring this team of consultants, but it's also the fact that, you know, if there's going to be a need for a new service, say it's a scanner, say it's more hospital beds, you know, say it's a new ambulatory surgery center, whatever it is, you have entrenched interests who are already established providers in the market, who are well-funded, who are going to fight over that new certificate of need, right? And so what you have are big, well-moneyed, established providers who have all the incentive in the world to grab up the new con and to push out potential new entrants to the market like Dr. Singh. And they're spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars ultimately fighting and competing in court and not in the market. And that is just, if we're talking about waste, right? There's no more wasteful thing to do than to spend your time, you know, squabbling over who should get permission from the government to innovate.
Yeah, and well, absolutely. And, you know, Dr. Singh himself, it's interesting because I think that you mentioned to me when we were talking about this case earlier that he's actually an immigrant. So he comes to the United States from another country. And the type of thing that you're talking about, I mean, it almost sounds like sort of rule of the strong man type of situation. That's the sort of thing that people usually leave other countries to come to the United States because they want to be able to, you know, to live the American dream and to compete fairly and to have the opportunity to build their business. And so it seems like, you know, Dr. Singh is sort of in a unique situation that way, where he might have experienced those things where he originally comes from and then come to the United States. Was he surprised to find that this is the system in the land of the free?
Oh my gosh, yes. I mean, it's not just Dr. Singh, you know, he's an immigrant, he comes from India. We're also representing a man named Dipendra Tiwari, who's an immigrant as well, and in a case challenging Kentucky's certificate of need law. And, you know, we've spoken with other immigrants, all of whom say that they are just shocked when they come to this country that a system like this could exist in America. What they thought was the land of the free, what they thought was the land of opportunity, what they thought was a place where they could come and try to innovate and try to provide, you know, services that people need in a competitive way, pursuing the American dream as they saw it from the outside, and then coming in and running into this certificate of need system. It's just shocking. We actually spoke with somebody, you know, a few days ago, who has been dealing with an issue in, you know, a state I won't name, but one of these states that has a certificate of need law. And he was told, okay, you have to get a con to provide the service you want to provide. And he was like, okay, how do I do that? One of the things that the agency told him to do was, well, first, you have to show your service is needed. And to do that, you need to consult with the established providers in your area. So the government actually told him to go talk to existing providers that he wanted to compete with to determine whether they thought his services were needed. It's just fun.
Oh, jeez. Well, and that kind of goes into the legal theory of this case and of others, because at the heart of your case, and I know there are multiple claims, but at the heart of it is really this state anti-monopoly clause. And I think based on, you know, your overview of the case and our discussion of this issue and how it's played out over the past 50 years, it seems, at least from a layman's perspective, kind of obvious why these types of laws would be inherently monopolistic. But what actually is an anti-monopoly clause? What is North Carolina's clause say? And you know, is this unique to North Carolina, or does this exist in other states?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly these kinds of clauses exist, you know, in states across the country in different forms. North Carolina's is one of the two oldest in the country. It's very similar, if not identical, to Maryland's. So both of them say something to the effect of perpetuities and monopolies are contrary to the genius of a free state and shall not be allowed. That language is pretty categorical. It doesn't say, so, you know, listeners of this call might be familiar with, you know, economic liberty litigation in other contexts involving, for instance, like the substantive due process type claims involving, you know, rational basis review. Nothing about Article 1, Section 34, which is North Carolina's anti-monopoly clause, suggests that rational basis review is warranted. It just says monopolies are contrary to the genius of a free state and shall not be allowed.
And that's a really good point because, you know, unfortunately, you know, healthcare litigation to challenge regulations in the healthcare industry, no matter how detrimental to the public health, you know, it's usually a really, really difficult thing to do for exactly what you're saying. Because if a regulation exists and it's some sort of economic or property regulation, it usually gets rational basis standard, which is extreme deference to the government. And in an issue that even, you know, purportedly involves health and safety, it makes it very, very hard to overcome that. Right now, here you've not only got the anti-monopoly clause at issue, which you're saying has a different kind of deference, but also this isn't exactly a health or safety issue, right? I mean, we're not talking about the government protecting public health, at least not in the part of the con law that you seem to be concerned with. We're talking about the government essentially picking winners and losers and deciding who gets to play in the market and who doesn't. Is that kind of your understanding of it?
Well, that is exactly right. And so the question under this provision that we're talking about isn't, you know, does the government have a compelling interest? Does the government have good intentions? Is this good policy? Those aren't the questions. The question, at least according to the way it's written and according to the way that courts have construed it, is this a monopoly? And if the answer is yes, it must be struck down. So I'll give you an example of how North Carolina Supreme Court has parsed that a little bit. So the court has said, for instance, that licensing regimes that regulate something to protect public health are not monopolies, right? Because anybody can enter the market as long as they meet objective criteria. But in 1973, the North Carolina Supreme Court considered a virtually identical version of North Carolina Certificate of Need law under the Anti-Monopoly Clause and struck it down. And I think I'd like to just, if I may, read the kind of the operative part of the opinion. It's just maybe a couple sentences, but it's really compelling and kind of revealing for how the court thinks about these issues. So the court said the commission, and there it's talking about the Public Health Commission, North Carolina, claims, and the statute purports to confer upon it, the authority to forbid the construction with private funds and suitable materials upon private property suitably located, a well-planned hospital, which is to be adequately equipped and staffed with a sufficient number of well-trained personnel in all categories. The sole reason for such prohibition being that in the opinion of the state, there are now in the area hospitals with bed capacity sufficient to meet the needs of the population. The hospital, which desires to engage in the business of caring for sick, injured, and infirm people, contends that this is in excess of the constitutional power of the legislature. We agree. And so the court struck down that provision under the state's anti-monopoly clause. And notice that in that language that I just quoted, the court is saying, look, this hospital meets all relevant health and safety regulations, but this isn't about health and safety. This is about picking winners and losers in the marketplace, and that is a violation of the anti-monopoly clause.
Okay, so I want to take a step back there because that sounds pretty definitive to me. But did you say, I mean, this decision is decades old. So why are you now having to go to court to defend Dr. Singh and his right to serve his patients if the court already made that decision decades ago?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the Congress in the mid-70s enacted legislation that encouraged states to, you know, enact certificate of need laws to qualify for federal funding. So after the decision in 1973, in about 1978, the North Carolina legislature reenacted a virtually identical version of the state's certificate of need law to qualify for that funding. And I think this kind of ties back to something we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, the state Supreme Court has said this is a monopoly, and the state's legislature has come back and said, no, we really want this, right? It's really important to us. Well, the Constitution doesn't really care if legislature thinks it's important. The Constitution cares, is it a monopoly or not? And we're saying under this prior precedent, it's definitely a monopoly, and so is the current con law, which is, you know, operates in the same manner.
Okay, so then what is the state actually arguing? Because now you filed this lawsuit, you filed it, about a year ago or so. The state went to court and asked the court to not only rule for them, but just to kick your case out of court, right? They filed a motion to dismiss. And again, yeah, the state says that this is really important to the legislature. But, you know, as you said, you have a pretty strong case on the books. It's clear that this is monopolistic type of behavior. So what is the state's legal argument? Why does the state think that, you know, that your case shouldn't be able to, that Dr. Singh shouldn't be able to have his day in court?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few arguments they're making, but if I could distill them to maybe like just kind of one point, I think the best way to put it is that the state is saying that when the legislature reenacted the con law in 1978, that mooted the Supreme Court's prior decision striking down the old con law, because the new con law has a series of what are called legislative findings of fact. So basically, there's a preamble added to the law that says, you know, this is really important for the health or safety. This is important to control costs. This is important to ensure an adequate supply of healthcare services, right? And so there's this kind of laundry list of ways in which the legislature is asserting the law furthers legitimate public health and safety purposes. And the North Carolina Court of Appeals in 2010 said that that legislative series of findings of fact effectively mooted the Supreme Court's old decision. And, you know, we could talk about why that's not true, but that's the rationale.
Wow. So you have a situation where, again, sort of a very uncommon situation where you've got real-world data, you've got economists, you've got the federal government, you've got medical societies all saying that, in fact, these laws not only aren't helpful to public health, but they're detrimental, that they don't contain costs. And then you have the North Carolina legislature turning around and saying, well, no, we actually think these things are true just because we say so. We're going to put that into our legislative findings, and now the court can't touch this, essentially.
That's totally true, and it's sort of wild when you think about this, right? Because, like, think about what's going on here. You have the legislature saying in 1978, after Congress enacted the law we were talking about earlier, the Healthcare Resources and National Health Planning and Resources Development Act, right? After that was enacted, you know, North Carolina is clearly responding to that. And part of the context for this declaration of findings by the legislature is they want to qualify for this funding, and they think that's really important. And so that whole rationale was totally threw out the door in the mid-80s when Congress repealed the law. Not only that, you have, as you mentioned, a ton of data coming out and studies saying, look, cons don't actually control costs. And finally, and this is kind of the most crazy part of this in my view, the MRI scanners didn't exist in 1978, or if they existed, they weren't in most hospitals, right? They weren't commercially available. Not until 1993 did North Carolina start regulating MRI scanners in the certificate of need law. So you have the government saying this series of findings of fact, you know, quote unquote, from 1978, somehow applies to a service that wasn't really on the market until like the late 80s, early 90s. It's just kind of wild.
Well, now let's, to be fair to, to the other side, they, and I know even when my colleagues have litigated these cases at the Goldwater Institute, you know, we often hear from the state or the state agency that, well, look, you know, an anti-monopoly clause is really put into these constitutions to stop the state itself from establishing a monopoly. So in other words, to stop the state from, you know, granting exclusive privilege to operate to just one business, or even just a few businesses, but just out of, the desire to do that. And these laws are a little bit different because there are, as you mentioned, there are other factors involved. So, you know, we're looking, a lot of them do have some sort of healthcare factor to them. You know, we do look at, if the facilities are clean or if the standards are up to par. And then, you know, again, the state is presumably using some kind of analysis, as flawed as it may be, to make the determination as to whether or not these services are needed for the public health. So the argument on the other side goes that, okay, even if we accept all of the rest, this really isn't the same thing as the state just granting an exclusive monopoly to one business. What do you say to that?
Well, I kind of would go back to what I was talking about earlier with the distinction between licensing and sort of a cartel, a government-created cartel, because it is the case that we've alleged in our complaint, and that's kind of still where this case is at, that Dr. Singh can meet all of those health and safety requirements, right? So what we're saying is the only difference between him and the guy down the street is that the guy down the street already exists, right? He's already offering his services, and Dr. Singh isn't. So he's on the outside looking in. therefore the state is saying his services aren't needed. So it's really just this need requirement, and need again is dependent on who's already operating. To your point about you were talking about monopoly clauses and kind of whether they exist to prevent the government kind of handing out a special privilege to one entity. This kind of also makes me think of, you know, one of the arguments that we're getting in this case as well, because there are multiple healthcare providers, right? In Dr. Singh's planning area, for instance, there's like 16 or 17 scanners. Well, then how's that a monopoly, right? Because there's more than one provider. What I would say is that the case law is pretty well established in North Carolina and some other states as well, that you can have a monopoly in, at least in legal terms, in a group of providers, as long as what's going on is that the state is basically capping the number of people who can enter the market, right? So if there's, again, no set of criteria that you could meet that doesn't depend on just the state deciding this is the number, then that's a monopoly at that point.
Sure. So you said that this lawsuit is still, you filed the complaint and you're sort of there. So where is the lawsuit? What's going on in the case today? And what are sort of the next steps for folks who want to pay attention to it?
Yeah. Well, so we had a hearing on the state's motion to dismiss early this year. It went on for quite a while, and it's interesting, we could talk about this a little bit, but the kind of juxtaposition between, you know, me as a pro bono lawyer and on the other side there being not just the state, but like, you know, five or six other people who are amicus attorneys on behalf of the hospitals, you know, who are being paid, you know, hundreds of dollars an hour to be there is always kind of funny, but and telling. But anyways, the status is that the court granted the government's motion to dismiss, and so we're currently appealing. And the court granted that motion to dismiss, by the way. I'm pretty sure the court didn't offer any reasoning in its order, but under that Court of Appeals decision that I mentioned from 2010, where the court said, oh, this old case is mooted. So at this stage, you know, we filed our notice of appeal. We're waiting to hear back from the court to get some transcript stuff for the record. But, you know, we should be going before the Court of Appeals in the next few months. So folks can look forward to that.
Well, that's great. Yeah, you know, that's another thing that's always frustrated me about the wheels of justice turning slowly is you have a situation where, you know, folks that want to apply for a certificate of need laws or applications, you know, they have to spend all this money. They have to spend all this time getting this application together. As you said, they have to basically hire economists and get experts to say that their services are needed. Then they have to wait months and months while competitor after competitor object to their application and the government ultimately denies them that right. Then they have to go into court, and then you have a situation where the state comes in and says, no, we're the state. If we say this is necessary, then it's necessary, you know, kick the case out of court. And then if it gets dismissed, you have to appeal all the way up before you've essentially won your right just to be able to make your case in court. Quite frustrating, I'm sure, for somebody like Dr. Singh, who really just, you know, wants to be able to serve his patients.
Yeah, and you know, the attitude that you've probably experienced this too, Christina, but the attitude that we've received, you know, walking into court and just kind of hearing the tone of the government's argument has always been something like how dare this one doctor come in and challenge this complex regulatory scheme that the whole state depends on, right? It's like, how dare you come in here and claim that this is a monopoly and unconstitutional? And I've always been sort of galled by that, the idea that, like, they sort of make Dr. Singh feel guilty for trying to do some good. It really, really gets me in kind of a way that some other cases don't.
Yeah, and certainly, again, to go back to the fact that Dr. Singh came to America to make a better life for himself and his patients, not exactly the type of thing that you would expect, but unfortunately all too common. I'm proud to be a member of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, and we actually just put out a paper called Competitors Veto for those of you who are listening that want to learn a little bit more about this and other cases. And, you know, Dr. Singh's case, as Josh kind of alluded to, is not unique. States across the country have these laws in place. They play out similarly in other states, everything from diagnostic equipment like Dr. Singh to surgical centers, to ambulance services being prohibited from starting up or operating, private hospitals. One of the things that we discuss in the paper that I think is so interesting is, you know, a lot of times the folks that want to get into this space are not, they're not asking for a government handout. They're not asking for subsidies. They're not asking for taxpayers to pay for their services. These aren't, you know, publicly funded. So essentially, they just want to operate their business, oftentimes at a lower cost and better services, and don't want anything from the government except permission just to be able to try that. And they can't get it. And of course, that affects so many different people. And we see it affecting, you know, mental health and addiction centers and just all across the board. So this is obviously it's a really big deal. It's a really big problem. And I hope, Josh, that you and IJ are successful in this case, because I think these state anti-monopoly clauses are really underutilized and not known much about. And so if you can be successful here, hopefully we can kind of turn the tides in the courts. But with that, why don't we go ahead and take some questions from our listeners?
When we get your request, you'll hear a prompt. Please state your name and affiliation and then ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Before the first question, just a reminder to our audience that you can check out Christina's recent white paper with RTP and the full schedule of upcoming calls and previously recorded podcasts at our website. Excuse me. Regproject.org, regproject.org. I'd note that RTP had several live events in the pipeline for last week and in the coming weeks, and it looks like we will be converting all of that programming into teleform calls like this one. So please be on the lookout for new announcements in the coming weeks. Looks like we have two people lined up for questions currently. Let's go to the first question.
Good morning or afternoon. My name is Barbara Haskins. I'm a physician, and I have just a comment. I've been a doctor for a long time, and I remember reading in the past, long ago, that places that wanted to curtail physician numbers and practice numbers, like this MRI case, it was happening because what they found is that rather than competition driving prices down, each provider sort of said, here's how much income I need to make, and I will price accordingly. So that healthcare costs were going up as the number of providers and equipment went up. But I think all that has changed, because now it's insurance companies that call the prices, and doctors are all under contract to insurance companies to provide a service at a set price. I mean, obviously, Medicare and Medicaid are huge, but a lot of doctors are billing insurance for what they get. And so I think the field has changed profoundly because of the influence of insurance companies, but I'm not sure that's filtered into people's understanding of the situation. So that's my comment. Thanks.
Thank you for your comment. And, you know, I would add one thing to your point, which is that one of the things that's often discussed in this context is that hospitals are lobbying for certificate of need laws, and that they're kind of kept in place by hospitals. And, you know, that is true. But it's also true that hospitals, you have to think about why they're doing that. And so to your point about the kind of market changing and different conditions that providers might be under, hospitals are required to comply with a bevy of regulations that make life pretty difficult for them. And I'm not saying they're justified in lobbying for certificate of need laws, but what I am saying is that we can sort of see why they're doing that. They're almost doing that as a defense mechanism, because for them, you know, the ability to provide MRI scanners is a source of revenue. And they're concerned that, you know, providers like Dr. Singh are gonna cut that revenue out for them. And so my thought on this is that, you know, we should be paring back certificate of need laws, but we should also be trying to think about ways that we can pare back, you know, regulations that make life incredibly difficult for not just hospitals, but all healthcare providers. Because in my view, you know, regulation breeds more regulation. You make life difficult for one private medical provider, you're going to start making life difficult for others as well. It's sort of a domino effect.
I don't think you can find a physician who would disagree with you. We are regulated into madness.
Yeah, and I'm sorry for that, but thank you for all you do.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have one more person waiting in the queue to ask a question. Again, if you'd like to join the queue to ask a question, please enter star, then pound. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, thank you, Larry White. I teach law at a Turkish university. First a comment on your last answer, that I think that when you're attacking the administrative burden, that it's much heavier on sole practitioners than it is hospitals, who can essentially afford people to be able to do that. And then my question is, you had mentioned that there was, in your lawsuit, that the state had filed a motion to dismiss. What was the basis of the state's motion to dismiss? That it couldn't be decided in the courts, or did they have some other real solid kind of opposition to that? Thank you.
Yeah, sure, I can talk about that. So there are kind of a few things going on here. One of the bases is that Dr. Singh didn't have standing and that his case wasn't ripe because he hadn't yet applied for a certificate of need. The court rejected that argument. So their 12B1 motion, the court rejected that. But their other rationales were basically that, all of our claims, so we have four. We have an anti-monopoly claim, an exclusive emoluments claim, which is very similar, an equal protection claim, and a substantive due process claim. And their argument was that all of these claims are subject to rational basis review, and that, the legislature had determined that this was a very important law for the public health and safety, and it really wasn't for the court to kind of question that, and for one doctor to kind of question that. And so, the court, again, didn't explain its rationale in its 12B6 order, but ultimately granted the motion. So I assume the judge, kind of bought that argument. But we're going to be excited to take that up to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
One other comment too. Your comment about the fact that solo practitioners or smaller facilities are hit harder by this because they're not able to absorb the massive cost of not only applying for but fighting opposition to it, maybe even in court. What I think is even worse is that it's not just bigger, more moneyed, established institutions that are pushing back against these market entrants, but a lot of times it's government-funded, meaning taxpayer-funded institutions that are doing that. So, for example, in Hawaii, where healthcare services are really, really lacking, especially in the outer islands outside of Oahu, patients usually have to be flown into Honolulu to be able to get special care, especially cardiac care. And of course, there's a lot of people in Hawaii who are elderly and need that cardiac care. So in Maui, back in 2006, a private hospital, again, not seeking government funds, but just wanting to operate, a private hospital sought a certificate of need because they wanted to open up a hospital where they could provide cardiac care right on the island to folks who lived on Maui. And it was a government-run hospital. It was the local government-run hospital that said, oh, no, we don't want that competition. That would hurt our hospital. So the Department of Health rejected the con. And so actually now, and this number is probably increasing, but last time I looked, there were more than 350 cardiac cases from Maui that have to be treated off-island each year because, and of course that's extremely expensive. You're flying people to another island just to be able to get the care that they need. Just what's amazing to me about that story is that this is the government hospital that objected to and ultimately was the reason that the private hospital was rejected. That's all with taxpayer dollars. So your money is being used to fight back against the little guy who wants to come in and innovate and provide these services. So it's just compounded upon compounded in this area.
Okay, very good. Yes, I was just going to say, Christina, we have one other person waiting in the queue. If you'd like to ask after that person, please enter star then the pound sign. The next question.
Hi, my name is Andrew Alexander. I'm a litigator in Kansas City. And I also practice in certificate of need law here in Missouri. My question is, in your antitrust claim, given its somewhat unique character in that it is a constitutional claim, is the jurisprudence available to you cabined to a specific constitutional context that is, relatively narrow to the concept of providing a monopoly or allocating the totality of the market share to one or a fixed set of market participants? Or do you have also available to you the broader, more traditional spectrum of antitrust, unreasonable restraint of trade jurisprudence?
That's a really interesting question. So what I would say is that North Carolina, for most of its history, North Carolina courts had a pretty standard analysis for their anti-monopoly clause. And that analysis was basically that if the government is granting an exclusive or special privilege to some or a few market participants and excluding everybody else, that's a monopoly. However, some North Carolina courts of appeals and even the state Supreme Court in one context have started to kind of blend the traditional anti-monopoly analysis with antitrust principles. And so what I would say is that, you know, our view, and I think the correct view, is that these are not antitrust clauses. They're anti-monopoly clauses, monopoly in the traditional sense of that term. And I think that's important because the more you delve into kind of antitrust principles and concepts, you start to water down the categorical nature of the test the court has traditionally applied. And so to the extent that comes up in this litigation, we're going to try to push back on it.
Christina, Josh, any further thoughts for audience at this point?
No, I just want to thank everybody for joining us. Thank you, Josh, for discussing your case and for the great work that you and the Institute for Justice are doing. And again, if listeners want to learn more about this, about common laws generally, but also the state constitutional challenges, I hope that they will check out the Regulatory Transparency Project's paper.
Thanks, Christina. And I should also note that, you know, there are definitely important and exciting cases kind of being filed in the state constitutional space for certificate of need. There are also federal challenges, you know, pending in several courts right now, including challenges filed by IJ. So I'd encourage folks to check out both state and federal litigation in this space.
Well, excellent. Thank you both for your time and expertise today. It's been a great discussion. We welcome listener feedback by email at rtp@regproject.org. Thank you all for joining us. Have a great day.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.